This time, the Socceroos come to the global table in 2006 and the extraordinary story of Zaire in 1974. And welcome to by far the greatest team, a football podcast in which we try to put an end to the question of who is the greatest football team in the world. Joining me, my name is Graham Dunn. I should introduce myself. And joining me as ever is Jamie Rooney. Hiya, Jamie.
Hello, Graham. Good to see you again. Good to be on the podcast again.
And we decided we need to go more international now. We need to bring in a view from beyond the UK because, of course, British teams are not at the heart of everything in the world. So where else to go but to that true footballing nation, Australia? Joining us is Shane. Hiya, Shane.
Hi, Graham. Jamie, thank you very much for being here. It's going to be interesting being the voice of a country.
There's a real onus there. So the my sort of great memory of Australian football comes really from Italia 90 World Cup when I was in Australia travelling during that, where England unusually had quite a good tournament. So I watched the entirety of that through the expert view of Socceroos captain Charlie Yankos, who is the expert summariser.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think, Jamie, unless there's any order of business you want to pick up.
Yeah, well, I think there might be a little bit of order of business to pick up, actually. We've got a few episodes out there now, and incredibly, people are listening and participating and getting in touch with us. So we've had some feedback this week, which was nice. Ooh. I think we've got a super fan. Cam Sharma has turned into a bit of a super fan. He's pinged me this week with a series of quiz questions, and they're not your standard quiz questions. They're really intriguing and bizarre, and quiz questions you wouldn't find in your pub night when you're down the pub with your mates for the quiz. And I thought it might be interesting just to bring one of them in, just to kind of give you a flavour of what these quiz questions are. The quiz question I've got, Shane, please feel free to participate in this as well. It's an open question to both of you.
I'll have a go. This could be interesting.
So the question is, what player jumped over a number of minis, the car, to celebrate his teammate's birthday?
Wow.
That is random. That is random. Evil Knievel. But I don't think he actually played any proper games. He was a useful holding midfielder, Evil Knievel. Had an unusually dour, because he had such a showbiz life. When he actually played this football, he was much dour. Just played a steady holder and didn't want anyone to know he was there. Okay, wow. Jumped over minis.
The level of obscurity of these questions, I mean, this isn't even the most obscure of all the questions. I mean, this is the genius of the feedback we're getting in right now. I wouldn't expect many people to know this. I'm quite happy to share the answer if you guys have, exhausted efforts or if you want to kind of throw a few
random guesses. Can you give us a clue of the era?
I can. It's the 1970s.
I'm going to assume back in the 70s as well, the coach wouldn't have been ecstatic with that as a celebratory.
Well, funny you should say that, Shane, because he did play for a football team where Brian Clough was the manager, and Brian Clough wasn't impressed with his party trick of jumping over minis. He's probably not noted for playing under Brian Clough. He's more noted for his time at Everton and Leeds United. And Cam has said to me that this is one of his all-time favourite players. He absolutely fell in love with this guy. So he's a bit of a flair player by all accounts. So answer to the question is, you might kick yourself, is Duncan McKenzie. Apparently in training one day as a youngster, he was only getting paid £12 a week. And the club was so poor, I think he was playing for Nottingham Forest at the time, the club was so poor that they had to run to the clubhouse where they had two bottles of lemonade to share amongst the whole team, because that was the facilities they had. And then to do this, you had to get over a hedge. So Duncan McKenzie had the party tricker jumping over the hedge so he would secure his lemonade. And then he was egged on by his teammates to say, I bet you can't jump that many. And they made a bet of effectively £5, which at the time was half his salary. And he realized he could earn more money by jumping over minis every week than he could actually play football. So the answer is Duncan McKenzie. It's a Cam Sharma favorite. And it's a quiz question that I think will get many of us stumped, which leads us into Australia.
So first up, we are going to Australia. We're going back to 2006, Australia's first major golden generation. Jamie, can you give us a bit of a background on how they got where they got to?
I can. I do feel like a proper tourist considering we've got an Aussie on here. But yeah, I mean, the background is that Australia have had a bit of a checkered past with the World Cup. I mean, it'd be interesting to understand how popular soccer had been, as my understanding is that it was taken to Australia in the 1800s, like most games when the Brits were touring around the world and exporting themselves and their cultures. But it never really take off. And I think it was through migration after the war, people that were people that were migrating from Southern Europe, Yugoslavia and places like that, that they were taking Greece and taking football with them. And then they started to garner a bit of support. Australia's qualifying record, though, for the World Cup, they qualified in 1974, the first time, and the team we're talking about qualified in 2006, 32 years later. But, I mean, it's ridiculous. They were traveling to incredible places to play qualification games. So the Oceania Federation they play in is not very strong. You know, you're playing Solomon Islands, Tahiti, Fiji, Vanuatu, you know, these teams that you're pretty much smashing. So there was a lack of competition and they were traveling to.
No such thing as an easy game. Vanuatu on a Tuesday night, wet Tuesday night.
I
stopped you in flow.
No, it's fine. I'm just kind of give the background. And I mean, not to go into great detail, but there was in the 1970 qualification, before they got qualified in 74, 4 years later, they played a round robin with South Korea and Japan in South Korea. So they've traveled all the way to South Korea. I mean, these are massive distances for a football team. And they've got through that. Then they get to play the first playoff against Rhodesia, which they then have to travel to Mozambique and then travel back to Australia to play the second game. They then go into another qualifier where they have to go to Israel and play a home and away against Israel. So they've traveled to three continents to try to qualify for the World Cup in 1970. So these guys have been stacked against it for a long period of time, purely based on geographically where they are in the world and that football really hasn't reached it that far. But 2006 is a golden generation in my mind. And that's why we wanted to showcase this particular team. It's littered with stars. And the qualification to get to the World Cup in particular was quite spectacular. And those two games that I hope we can talk to Shane about were against Uruguay. But that's me setting up. I think it's only fair that I, you know, toss the ball over to Shane to give us a...
I was going to mention the fact that I'm pretty sure we went to Montevideo for one of those games, because I remember clearly one or two of the players, you know, they were surrounded by 70,000 baying for blood Uruguayans going absolutely berserk. And I think some of the Uruguayan players after the game were seriously fleeing the country because they were not happy about losing. You know, more than the Australians were fleeing the country, I think the Uruguayans were bolting. So you're right. I mean, football in Australia has been traditionally, you know, we're talking through the 60s, 70s and 80s ethnic. Australia's Italian, Greek populations are massive, especially after World War II. I mean, Australia used to have the largest Greek population outside of Greece. So most of football was basically ethnic population from Europe. And then it's the Premier League, I think, that probably dragged football through in the 90s and the 2000s. Man U and Liverpool, Craig Johnson got football up, okay? And that's why I'm a Liverpool supporter. And then you got normal sports started to become a bit secondary and football started to become into the primary as well. And before you know it, football became, you know, a third or fourth sport in Australia, which is pretty big. The 2006 was a golden generation because I don't remember a team for Australia that had that many players playing in the equivalent of Serie A, Premier League, the Bundesliga. We've never had that many players that were playing in first team teams playing for the Australian team. I mean, literally the starting 11, they were all playing in decent leagues. more so than even the last World Cup, whereby I don't even know if we had one or two. 2006, 2010, we had heaps of, you know, we had a whole starting lineup, and some of them were seriously good. Obviously, Cahill and Viduka were fantastic. Bosnich was pretty. I think it was Bosnich in 2006, or was it Schwarzer by then?
Schwarzer. I think it's Schwarzer by then.
Even then, fantastic. Lucas Neal was pretty good Premier League player at that stage. Bresciano, John Aloisi, Danny Tiaro, all those guys. They had really good players. They were good. They were good, solid professionals. It was a professional team. Australians pride themselves on sport. We're a country whereby any sport, we're going to support it. Even if you don't generally support it, you will support it when Australia's playing.
As you said, the qualification for it itself is, it's always been a little complicated, and especially, you know, in the early days of the World Cups where, you know, there are fewer and fewer places available. So how kind of Australia ended up having to play in Uruguay?
I think it's the rating system. We get the last rated out of the, what's the South America? Is it the Conmebol Bowl or whatever it is? That we've traditionally got the last rated out of them with the highest rated, because Australasia's just been so historically weak. With football teams, it's almost like, no, I don't mean to be rude, but almost like wasting a position if you're going to sit there and have someone that's playing almost amateur. But then by that stage, if you have a look now, you know, the whole Asian region in the last 25, 30 years has gone through the roof with regards to decent teams, even Middle Eastern teams now. It really was far more of a global sport. But back then, yeah, we had to go to South America. And it was just, to be fair, most of the time Australia got pasted.
As you say, that era team was suddenly something completely different, wasn't it? And
yeah,
because they're standing in the Premier League, I mean, was there optimism for Australia actually achieving anything in that World Cup?
I can't remember what our group was, but there was, because we also had Gus Hiddink's manager, and he was good. Like, he was a really, he wasn't past it. He was still pretty good. In fact, I think after Australia, he went back to Ajax and got them into the semi-finals of the Champions League. So he was a pretty good manager. And it was the first time, I think, that Australia took it seriously and we actually got a pretty good team. We knew we'd be competitive. We should not get pasted. And as we went through, I mean, I still remember being in, and I hate to say this, the walkabout with a lot of Australians when Lucas Neal went for that challenge in the box against Italy. And I remember sitting there going, genuine disappointment, because I thought we could have beaten Italy. That's saying something, because they were a lot better than us.
How did Gus Hiddink wind up as manager of Australia?
Well, we have to go back a little bit before Hiddink. So you had Frank Farina. He'd taken Australia to the playoffs, the World Cup playoffs in the 2002 tournament. They got, as Shane's already said, they got stuffed 3-0 by Uruguay in Montevideo, and that was the end of that. And to be honest, getting Australia to a final playoff wasn't a particularly difficult task. And the Australian Football Federation had a three-point plan. So they started taking football a bit more serious. And in the early 2000s, they set out three goals to establish a creditable league in Australia. And we've got the A-League that is credible. That is a league that, you know, we've seen players from abroad go and play in. And similar to how leagues have to establish themselves, they're taking older players, but that's exactly how the Premier League started. It brought a lot of older players in to establish itself, and then it grows. They also wanted to move to the Asian Federation, and for all the right reasons, because in Asia, they have competition, whereby in Oceania, there is no real competition. You get the odd blip here and there where New Zealand produce a particularly decent team, or the Solomon Islands turn up for a day, but there is no competition. And so they achieved that, and they achieved that right after this World Cup as well. So they were in the Asian Federation right after this World Cup. And I think it's worth pointing out, this is the second World Cup Australia qualified in their history in 2006. And since they've been in the Asian Federation, which is a lot tougher, more places available, but a lot tougher to qualify, Australia have qualified for every single World Cup finals from that point. They haven't missed one. So that point worked as well. And the final point was to qualify for a World Cup final. So when they got there, clearly they wanted to be recognised as not just participating, but serious contenders. And I remember that Italian game, Shane. I remember it vividly, just being a, you know, an enjoyable watcher, that Australia, they should have won that game. Italy had a player sent off. I think it was the guy who was headbutted by Zidane in the actual final. I think he was sent off.
Materazzi, yeah?
Yeah, so Italy... Materazzi, thank you. So Italy are playing with 10 men, and Australia have had their chances. And yeah, you're right, it's Lucas Neal he just has a moment of madness. He's gone down in the box. You're asking for trouble. You can't blame Fabio Grosso for going over, whether it was intentional or not. You're going to do that. You're going to win a penalty every single time. And then you've got, you know, Totti. I mean, he's not going to miss, is he really? And then Italy go on and play Ukraine in the quarterfinals. And you kind of think, could Australia with Hiddink giving them a job? But, you know, Hiddink had been brought in deliberately to replace Farina, and he just changed the mentality. You know, he had tactical qualities that Australia had probably been missing in their whole existence when it came to football.
To be fair to Lucas Neal, you know, him sliding for a challenge in the box was at least very Lucas Neal. So that was nice. Certainly, let's not say it was out of character. I mean, there's a fair chance that Kevin Muscat on the other flank was probably
Kevin Muscat.
That's it. Studs up, mate. Studs up. When he went down, there was a general groan in the walkabout from Australian fans who know Lucas Neal to go, "What a surprise! It's Lucas Neal. It's gone to ground for that tackle." Was it a shock?
I'm so glad you mentioned Kevin Muscat. As you started talking about it, I was thinking, wasn't there another fullback you used to? Oh, there you go, Kevin Muscat. Exactly.
And Danny Tiato in front of him. So yeah, you're filling out all sorts of names, aren't we? From the Australian supporters' perspective, besides the overwhelming pride, which all of my friends certainly felt, and the whole of the walkabout did, you could tell, there was genuine disappointment. Because it's like, no, we thought we actually could have beaten them given penalties. And I know what I love was the Italian fans in there who we were obviously having a drink with and a chat with. They were genuinely scared. If you've got the Italians legitimately fearful of losing, as a small country, you've done pretty well.
That whole World Cup could have ended slightly less. You know, there's quite a lot of hope on that. And yet in the first game against Japan, they're one down with about 10 minutes to go until Tim Cahill comes on. In my mind, I can't quite remember. I think I remember Cahill potentially had an injury doubt around him because it seemed odd that he wouldn't be starting. But when Cahill came on, he did make quite a difference, didn't he?
Well, Tim Cahill did that all the way through his Australian career is sensational. Actually, I mean, his career at Everton was pretty good too, but his career at Australia was brilliant. I mean, I think though in that World Cup, the reason that Cahill didn't start is because we had Viduka up front probably. And at the time, Viduka was pretty decent.
And, of course, he had Harry Kewell.
Sorry, I forgot about Harry Kewell like I did when he was playing for Liverpool in the Champions League final. Anyway, sorry, I forgot he even played. he was sensational at the time, too. So, I mean, you know, we had... Actually, now that we mention these names, really was our golden generation. Like, that's comfortably the best team we've put out.
I think when you look at where Australia had been before, this is the first time you had players who I think would walk into other sides across the tournament there. So
yes,
Viduka, Kewell, Cahill, they're all, you know, I think they start for almost any team in that tournament. And that felt like that was the difference.
Yeah, agreed. And even Bresciano in midfield, I mean, he was playing for, can't remember who he was playing for, I think it might have even been Parma. And they were in the Serie A. And they were solid. More than anything else, who are solid professionals, if you know what I mean. And having someone like Gus Hiddink, used to having professionals, you know, nothing against the previous manager, but it's just a different class. You're getting a manager who's used to having stars around him, and he's now got actual talent to work with. That just brought it all together, really. I mean, I went to the World Cup in 2010, and we had pretty much the same team churned out for the 2010 World Cup too. In Germany.
I was going to pick up on Hiddink and his tactics because I think it is worth noting in the playoff game against Uruguay. So in the first game, Shane references some of the hostilities that were experienced in Montevideo in 2001 when Australia played Uruguay in a playoff again 4 years later, 2005. And what's remarkable about this bunch, the guys in the back room, basically, the guys and girls in the back room, they prepared for this. So even before they knew who their opponents were going to be in South America, they'd narrowed it down to six or seven. Because in the South American group, you can generally do that. You know, there was teams that had qualified already. There were teams that weren't going to get anywhere. So they could work out, you know, within a degree of accuracy, who they're going to play. So they, before the playoff was to take place, they'd already gone over and scouted a base camp in the north in Colombia and a base camp in the south in Buenos Aires in order to, like, get the team set up ready for their playoff in South America. So they're already beginning to take this a lot more seriously than they had previously. And as it turned out, it's Uruguay. They base themselves in Buenos Aires. So there are, all the nonsense they experienced in 2001 has gone away, you know, trying to keep the players up late, delaying the bus to the ground, all of the kind of the gamesmanship and that kind of hostile atmosphere. They've done everything they possibly can to reduce that. But even then, Uruguay tried to play the game. They try to change the fixture from one day to another. They try to play the kickoff time. They try to change the referee. All of this disrupt the flow of Australia. Their plan was to stop Australia flying back on their scheduled flight and be delaying them for a day, because the second game was going to be 4 days later. So if you delay them for a day, they could be more fatigued when they're there. So all this is going on. But it backfired on the Uruguayans because the Australians were well prepared. Regardless of when the game was taking place, and it did take place the time that FIFA got involved and said, no, this is when the game's going to take place. So Uruguay lost that. But the Australians were sponsored by Qantas, and Qantas flew a chartered jet over to Montevideo that was kitted out with first-class seats, massage tables, that was ready to go straight after the game. So they were maximizing time. So the Uruguayans, their plane, they had problems with their plane, and they had to fly a scheduled flight to Sydney, Australia for their game. So it's backfired. But going into that second game, and this is my point with hitting, after 31 minutes, it's goalless. They lost the first game 1-0. Away goals do count. So you concede a goal, you're really up against it. You've got to bag two just to get parity and three, just to kind of go through the legs. So, you know, that tight unit is really important. And hitting starts with Popovic and Kjaer's on the bench. Popovic, after 31 minutes, gives Recoba, Uruguay's best player, dangerous from step blazer, an elbow in the face, only gets a yellow card. Now, Hiddink immediately takes him off and brings in Harry Kjaer. So he's replaced a defender for an attacker. He's seen the pattern of the game. He's used the first 30 minutes to understand the pattern of the game. He can see the opportunities. Within 2 minutes, Kjaer and Viduka, they link up, that old Leeds partnership. Kjaer has a bit of a miskick, but it lands to Bresciano. Bresciano and Kjaer were quite new to this team. They'd only been playing for a year or two before, regardless of their ages. Bresciano scores and Australia win 1-0. It stays that way right for extra time and it goes to penalty kicks. And I can't imagine the jubilation that was in that stadium. 86,000 in the Stadium Australia. I have to say, this is a bit of a digression, Shane, forgive me. I do love the way Australia just use literal names for everything. I mean, they've got a stadium. What are we going to call it? Let's call it Stadium Australia. It's fantastic. And I couldn't help but look at some strange, places. I think you are. And this will prove this fact, because there's a place just outside Adelaide called, and it's a cave, and it's called Where It Wasn't There Last Year Cave. it's literally called Well, It Wasn't There Last Year.
It's worth finding out as well with the Gus Hiddink thing. There's two things with the Gus Hiddink thing. One, those players that went to Montevideo to play, the nice thing was, because they were playing in senior competitions, they'd all taken hostile derbies and places. They'd all been to places. Hey, no one's been to Montevideo on a World Cup when you've got 70,000 screaming Uruguayans baying for blood. But at least if you've been to the same, if you've played for Inter Milan and you're playing against AC Milan or something like that, flares are going off in the stands, especially in the early 2000s. Do you know what I mean? There's been some hostile games, I can't remember if Lucas Neal was playing for West Ham at the time, but you know, if he's gone for a London derby, that's going to be fiery. At least they've, with that level of experience globally, at least they've played in areas where you go, okay, we've copped hostile experiences before in sports. And the other thing about Gus Hiddink, I mean, besides the fact that I think he might still own a property in Australia because he's loved that much and we may have just gifted it to him, in the lead up and all the way through the tournament, at no stage did he say anything other than, I expect to qualify. With his team, I expect to qualify. And he's brutal on it. He goes, I'm not here to make up numbers. I expect to qualify. With this team, I expect qualification. He was ropeable after the Italian game. It was great to watch because it shows a guy who literally believed in the project that he did. Pat yourselves on the back. He's like, I can't believe he lost that.
I was going to talk about the group because we spoke briefly. The group included Japan, the game you talked about, an amazing game. The last 10 minutes is incredible. Cahill gets to... in the 84th and I think 87th. And then I think it's John Aloisi bags a third in injury time. These are the first goals that Australia had ever scored in the World Cup finals. What did that feel like, Shane?
Well, the nice thing was that I was well into football by that stage. So I'd spent 8 years being, you know, Premier League nuts and fans. So, I mean, I did spend a lot of time drunk during that World Cup, but that's because I kept watching Australia at a pub with all my friends and had all my Australian friends over here at the time. So it was pretty awesome. So pride that we'd actually moved so quickly into being competitive and good. That was the pride for me, that we'd moved from just being okay to being legitimately good. Not great, good, really good.
That group was challenging because after Japan, next up is the hardest of the lot. It was Brazil, isn't it?
Brazil, 2006. Brazil, anytime, generally a decent team to play against. They had been to the final in the previous World Cup. You've got, you know, your quality players. Ronaldo is playing in that football tournament as well. And it's a respectable 2-0 defeat. I don't actually remember that game too much about that game, actually. It's one of those ones where Brazil were playing, you kind of, I don't know, I just think I turned off on that particular moment. I can't remember anything.
No one's watching the opposition.
No, that is true. I do remember the final group game. I can't remember, actually. I'm so uninterested in that game, Shane, I haven't even done any research on it. However, the final group game, Graham, I don't know if you remember, against Croatia, the game finished 2-2, but something very significant happened in World Cup history in that game.
Well, it's an interesting go. I can't remember. You're going to have to remind me.
As soon as I tell you, you will remember, I promise you. Graham, are you going to get there? Or, I mean, this is turning into a quiz this week, isn't it?
Well, unless it's Luka Modric making his debut.
It's a lot more damaging than that. I mean, if I were just to say the name Graham Poll, what would you think of instantly?
Okay, so Graham Poll, well, he had a couple, didn't he? He wasn't the one who two yellow cards, was he? He was, God, I do remember something about this. It was a bit of a, oh, is this the one okay. Does he? Is this the game where he books someone three times?
Yeah, Simenic gets three yellow cards from Graham Poll, and there's two sending offs in this game as well.
By the way, I'm sorry. That's just to go back to the Brazil game. I do remember that because I was there
in what? Germany.
Yeah, I was. I went to the Allianz Arena for that game.
You sort of only partially remember. Presumably, you had a few beers by this stage.
It is music. It's the middle of summer, so it's fair to say Stein's work. Well, I was there for that game. So that game, 2-0, Ronaldinho was playing, I think. We're at the Allianz Arena.
Yeah.
Yes.
And we played really well. Actually, Australia was solid. That they were the 2-0, I mean, that was 1-0 up until about the 80th minute, and I think they scored a second one. And again, it was one of those games whereby the Brazilians kind of were like, that was a lot harder than we ever expected. You know, they put in they raised the gear when they wanted to, but I remember watching it going, we're making a decent fist of this. In fact, we might even hit them on the break.
I mean, I remember watching that game, and as ever in these situations, you always are supporting the underdog, and you know, you might find this difficult to believe, that I think it's probably the only occasion as an Englishman I've ever wanted Australia to win any sport whatsoever.
Well, to be fair, I get that. I mean, I'll never support England in the Ashes, but when it comes to football, I can't be more pro-English.
Yes, this is the Premier League impact.
Three yellow cards for the Croatian game, Jamie. Nice.
Yeah, Simenic got three yellow cards, and if you watch it back on YouTube now, you can see Simenic, when he's receiving his third yellow card, is the most confused on the pitch because he's expecting to walk. He's already had two yellow cards. He remembers them. And though he's giving Graham Poll some verbals, he's expected to walk. And when Graham Poll doesn't brandish the red card, he's more confused than anyone and stays on the pitch. And the commentators are going into his credit. The commentators just go crazy.
So he gets his second yellow card and doesn't get sent off. And then does he get a third and get sent off? I've got a vague memory of this all. But it didn't, in the end, it didn't have a material impact because Australia draw that game and qualify, don't they?
The Ukrainian team that Italy played after they beat Australia, did that have Shevchenko and Rebrov
in 2006, they did, yeah. They were both in that team, yeah.
Yeah, not the worst front two.
No,
definitely not.
But I like this Australian team, and you will never know. It's a big what if, but I think they could have given Ukraine a game, and Gus Hiddink could have been celebrating his second successive semi-final in the World Cup after getting to the semi-finals with South Korea the World Cup previously.
We should get on shortly to judging Australia, but before we do, I just want to pick up on Tim Cahill, what you were talking about there. His breakthrough at Everton came relatively late in his career. I mean, he was mid-20s by the time he went to Everton.
Yep.
I had somehow forgotten, I hadn't realised. So Tim Cahill plays four World Cups, appears in four World Cups for Australia, which is already kind of unheard of for any Australian to be in four World Cups. His first one is in 2006, and he was already 27. 27, yeah. And he plays his first World Cup, and he plays four of them. He's another, you know, he's still going at, 39 or something like that.
He was good from pretty late in the Premier League too. I mean, even when he retired, there was probably a little bit left in the tank. He's just one of those guys.
But
he was a great angry footballer too. Like, just proper competitive blood streak. Yeah. Reminds me of like a Dennis Wise striker or something like that. He's just really like giving up.
Yeah.
He had far more qualities than Dennis Wise, I have to say.
He did, but it was more about just grit as well. Like, he's a fighter. Proper fighter.
So let's get to ranking Australia in the realms of football greatness. Jamie, we'll start with you. We have, of course, five categories of greatness.
Ooh,
I think I can remember them now. I'm almost got them off pat now. All-time greats right at the top, followed by true greats. Touch of greatness are in that sort of middle tier. Edge of greatness, maybe not so. And then our favourite, the blinkered greats, where they are only great in the eyes of the beholder. Jamie, where would you go with Australia 2006?
Yeah, this is tricky. I don't think they're blinkered greats. I think they're way bigger than that. Their greatness goes beyond the shoreline of Australia. Oh, I don't know. I think there's more of an edge of greatness to this team, I feel. And I'm just kind of flirting with I think that there's a touch of greatness because it is a combination of planning, a golden generation of players, a brilliant manager, an incredible sport mad country backing them all the way, 86,000 watching them in the second game against Uruguay, and a few of them, as we've learned in Germany, following them, even though they don't remember. I think, I would say touch of greatness for me.
Shane, are you going to give it the full Glenn McGrath and go all-time greats? Where do you put them?
They're between blinkered greatness and a touch of greatness.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're going to rank them against other football teams, you're going to get poleaxed. But what they did better than because talent-wise, they were great for Australia and they were solid professionals, but for pure talent, there's going to be 400 teams that you mentioned that are going to be more talented. Maximising the talent they had, that they did as well, if not better than most teams I know. But that's not great. That's blinkered in a touch.
I think I'm inclined to agree with you. I think the part of the story I really like is there's a real legacy to this.
Yes.
So Australia this isn't a flash in the pan. This isn't one. It kind of came from nowhere. On the one hand, Australia hadn't really been anywhere, hadn't made it anywhere in a World Cup before. But by the time they landed, they belong there.
Yes.
And I think that's probably the greatest credit you can give them, isn't it?
It is. And the lovely thing is it gave a wonderful sport a real uplift in the country as well for the everyman who hadn't watched a lot of it. And now all of a sudden, football in Australia is five times bigger as a result of this. So what it's done is huge. Still wouldn't call it the greatest team you've ever seen. It's just that it's one of those ones that's a fabulous story. They worked their butt off. They maximised what they had. But, there's teams that are just, they'd kill them.
I love the brutal honesty. So I think we're agreed. Australia 2006, edge of greatness.
I'll take that.
Excellent. So next up, this is one of my favourite teams, one of my favourite stories that we're going to cover. We're going back to 1974 and we're going to the Leopards of Zaire. a team which just has extraordinary iconic value, I think. And I think there are some misunderstandings around that team and what became. There's a huge amount of confusion. You could write a film about everything that went on there. But Jamie, can you maybe set the context as to why Zaire, even being at the 1974 World Cup, was an achievement in itself?
Yeah, I do fear I may be biting off more than I can chew with this particular story, because, as you say, it's incredible. I mean, before 1974, let's go back to the 1960s and Congo, the Democratic Republic of Congo, as it was called then, is freeing itself of a brutal colonizer in Belgium, where the people of Congo have been tormented for decades. They have their freedom. This guy, President Mobutu, in 1965, this is the guy that probably has the biggest contributing factor, not to the football team, but to Zaire history. He forms his one-party totalitarian military dictatorship, takes over the country, calls them the Popular Movement of the Revolution Party, not to be confused with the separatist movement group, the People's Front of Judea, or the the Judean People's Front, different parties. But this guy, he sets out an agenda to suppress his rivals, by any means possible. So effectively, there's no challenge to his dictatorship. You know, he's got all of the qualities of a classic dictator. I wonder why they've never had top trumps for dictators. I think that would be quite fascinating, wouldn't it? It'd be a bunch of men, because, you know, you don't get many female dictators, but that would be an interesting game of top trumps. I wonder what the top topics would be. But anyway, he set himself in, he's gained and garnered support from the United States by aligning himself as an anti-communist. At the time, you got this Cold War going on between the USSR and USA. So he's got in bed with the USA and they pretty much support his regime. But then he invests in sport. So he's established his country and he invests in sport. And so this is an 8-year plan, an effort that gets Zaire to where they are. And this is a really good team. This is a team that won the African Championship in 1974, beating Egypt in the semi-final, and then going on to beat Zambia after a replay. A replay in a national tournament is always a bizarre thing, but they went to a replay. They beat in Zambia. So this is a pretty solid team that's going to Germany for the 1974 World Cup, albeit in very dubious circumstances.
And of course, they're coming to the World Cup at a point where African teams appearing at the World Cup, which we now sort of take for granted, was itself a bit of a rarity. So they are the first sub-Saharan African team to appear in the World Cup.
That's correct. Morocco had been there in 70, but Africa had been fighting a long and hard battle to get recognition and a place in the World Cup finals. And the only way you're going to get better is if you're playing against top teams and you're going to major tournaments. We reflected on this with Australia, the previous team. You know, once you're at the top table and you're able to participate with the best teams, you improve. It's just the natural order of things. And so Morocco have been there in 1970 and they've had a credible show. And then, yeah, Zaire are drawn in a really tough group. They've got defending champions Brazil. It's a different Brazil from 1970, but it's still Brazil. They've got Yugoslavia, and they've got, and I'm not even joking when I say this, a very good Scotland team in their group. And I feel bad that I have to qualify that. But I think the humour that gets attached to the Scottish national team is sometimes unfair, because they have in the past had excellent teams. And this one in 1974, this version was a really good team, and one we're going to feature on this podcast in the future. But for Zaire, this is a tough, tough group.
Based on my limited reading, they made it look tough too.
Well, definitely so.
Wow.
This team arrives with, I suppose, unprecedented expectations. Okay. Presidential expectations.
Yeah. Okay. Trump-like expectations.
Yes.
Pretty much. Yeah. I mean, the Mobutu, the president of Zaire, he wasn't just sending the team to compete. He genuinely believed that the team would win the World Cup. And he showered the players with gifts before they left. He was giving them houses. He gave them Volkswagen Passats and jewelry. And, you know, he was backing the team financially. And, you know, it wasn't by accident. It was by design. He banned the players from playing in other countries. So all of the Zaire players had to be home-based, which in turn benefited Zaire, because then you've got club teams like Mazembe and AS Vita that were winning the equivalent of the African Champions League at that time as well. So, you know, they're taking titles. So you've harnessed the quality, you've kept the quality in your league, and it's blossomed in the club game. But I mean, this has all happened to a backdrop of, you know, a classic dictator who is basically reaping the riches of the country and allowing his own people in the country to, you know, suffer poverty and all manner of horrors of what you would probably find under a dictatorship. Not that I've ever lived under a dictatorship, so I can't really talk from experience on this one.
Are we comfortable that there was probably a solid amount of repossession of said gifts straight after this World Cup?
Well, it gets worse than that. So they play Scotland in the first game and they lose 2-0 and they put up a fight.
So that was my first question, because I know what the second game, I know what the second game scoreline was, and I also know one of the great substitutions of all time.
Yeah. Absolutely. And
nothing screams tactical awareness quite like substituting, I don't know, a 5'9" goalkeeper for someone that's just come out of the Munchkin land in The Wizard of Oz. That when you're, I think it was at 4-0 down or something to that effect. When you're 4-0 down, and you're halving the size of your goalkeeper, that is a tactical ingenuity that I've never seen before. What I know of it as well, 9-0 didn't even flatter Yugoslavia. That's how many more they could have banged in.
So Zaire lose the second game 9-0, having a quite a creditable first game against Scotland and losing 2-0. Jamie, what happened to I mean, there was a chance that, I mean, you could argue it looked a bit as though their heart wasn't in that game against Yugoslavia. And I guess that's partly because that game almost didn't happen.
Their morale was very low, and for good reasons. So the way that these FIFA World Cups are organised is there's a pot of money, a purse, and quite a good sizable. I mean, it's equivalent. I think the Zaires were expecting around about 45K each, you know, which is a good amount of money in 1974. It's life-changing. So, you know, they've qualified as of right. They feel they're going to get a good payday that's going to set them up for life. But Mobutu hasn't just sent coaches with the football team. He sent government officials. He sent security staff. He sent specialists along with the team. So you've got this huge entourage, and the entourage are responsible for the booty, the bonuses that FIFA would pay. And the entourage decided to keep it for themselves.
Oh.
So the Zaireans.
I did not know this part of the beach. That's a diamond.
Well, so Zaire as well were sharing a hotel with Haiti at the time. Haiti had qualified for the World Cup. They were on an only World Cup as well. And the Haitians were coming in with bags of clothes and jewelry. So they're seeing a team in the World Cup bringing back all these gifts that they're buying with this purse. And then they're going to the dignitaries within the team and they're saying, you know, where's our money? And they were frankly told, well, we've kept it all. There's no money left. We're not going to pay you. And this happens between Scotland and Yugoslavia. So, yeah, their heart wasn't in it when they went to Yugoslavia. In fact, they refused to play the football match.
That explains our discussion regarding the substitution of a second. I don't even think it was a second choice. It was a third choice goalkeeper that was probably the second cousin of the person in row five. I mean,
they do. They make that substitution. I watched some highlights of this game this afternoon, which is fascinating. They do make that substitution after 20 minutes or so. 3-0 down, bring the new keeper on, who, as you say, is notably shorter. Not something that has historically helped goalkeepers in the world, but, you know, there have been a few. And, you know, it's quite a statement substitution that, isn't it? We're going to take the keeper off. We think it's all his fault. Having seen the goals he conceded, none of them appear to be his fault either. And they bring the new guy on, and within 1 minute, he concedes a fourth goal.
So the goalkeeping question is Dimby Tobilandi, who comes on. He's got a record of playing football. I can't find any appearances, really, other than this one we're talking about, in terms of the research. And it is on the 21st minute. But the players are protesting. The players have already decided they don't want to play this game. They've been instructed by FIFA. They've been given a thick ear from Mobutu as well. You know, he's basically been on the phone to them, telling them that they will play this game, even though they feel there's a grievance because the money that they thought they were going to get, they thought was guaranteed, is no longer going to be seen. It's gone, and they're not going to see it. FIFA offer them a token amount of money to play the game, which they do. And they're protesting. So you've got the goalkeeper that comes on, but you've also got Andeye Malumba, who is this tall striker. He was the top goal scorer in the African Nations Cup in 1974 when Zaire won it. And he also gets sent off in this game, and he gets sent off for kicking the referee up the backside. But he actually didn't kick the referee up the backside. It was his teammate, Mwempu Elunga, who we will talk about again, believe me, who'd kicked the referee up the backside, but the referee hadn't seen it, so he just turned around and he saw the guy, and then he decided to...
Sounds like Graham Poles is the referee in this game. So this is amazing.
Absolutely. But Mwempu Elunga, I think, who was the culprit who kicked the referee up the backside, I think was potentially trying to get sent off himself because he was taking the protest really seriously. And he went a step further in the game against Brazil.
So let's move on to the next game. Where are we going after 9-0 defeat?
So what happens in between the Yugoslavia 9-0 defeat and the Brazil game is the president is furious. You know, he had high hopes. He's been telling all of his high society friends that his team are going to do wonders at this World Cup, and then they've just been embarrassed by what at the time was the highest defeat in World Cup finals history. So he's furious, and, you know, I don't know much about dictators, but I think what I do know is that you don't want to get on the wrong side of them. And so the players are on the wrong side and they take an absolute bashing. And Mobutu sends across a bunch of effectively guards or security men across to give the guard the team in no uncertain terms that they will perform in the next game. And they're threatened that if they lose by more than 4-0, then do not come home. Do not come home. It's not worth your while coming home. And you know, so the players obviously have had this immediate threat. If they lose by 4 goals or more, then they're in for it and they're worrying about their families. I mean, before we get to the Brazil game, though, I find for a dictator, this is quite rational behaviour. I mean, he could have said, do not lose the game, but he's actually picked a realistic scoreline against Brazil.
Given them a chance.
Exactly that. He's like almost calculated the possibilities.
You can argue it's one of the better pictures.
I may be a dictator, but I'm not Hitler.
Well, the impressive thing about it as well is that he just simply said, don't bother coming home. I mean, normally it would be a hell of a lot worse than that.
It is, but it worked. The players were terrified and they go into the Brazil game and they're losing 1-0. We're partway through the second half. They are playing within themselves, but again, they've still got the backdrop. They're losing their money. So then they switch instead of protesting. They look to opportunities to waste time and buy time from the game. And we get to probably one of the most famous clips we've ever seen in World Cup history when Mwempu Elunga is standing in the Zaire wall on the edge of the box. You've got Rivelino standing over a free kick. It's in a prime position. They've seen Brazil score these free kicks before, although not Pele, Graham, as we've learned from previous podcasts. And he, while the ball is stationary and the referee hasn't blown the whistle, Elunga rushes out and kicks the ball as far down the field as he possibly can and gets a yellow card. And at the time, he was a bit of a joke. And I remember this, watching this early in the 2000s, and it was on those World Cup showreels, and he was still seen and considered a bit of a joke. And it was kind of, I think John Motts at the time, God rest his soul, kind of said that, you know, this is, sadly, this is African ignorance. And there was this whole kind of like a, you know, unwelcomeness to African teams in the World Cup at that time. It wasn't like, you know, a FIFA family welcoming everyone. It was selected members, and Africa wasn't really welcome. So this became a bit of a joke, but the joke's on everyone who didn't get it at the time, because as I've learned, as we're learning now, that, you know, this was a deliberate play. Elungu knew the rules. He knew how to play football, and he knew exactly what he was doing when he set this ball down. Not only was he creating comedy gold, which it was, there's a serious undertone to what's going on, we only realise many years later.
Is a theological and ethical question, which I'm sorry to have burdened you with a theological and ethical question. Surely the Brazilian team have an idea of what's been said. Yeah? Is there a point where you sit there and you go, as a Brazilian player, you're 2-0 up or 3-0 up, you go, take the foot off the gas, guys.
Well, Shane, it's a really good question because there is a conspiracy theory that the result was arranged. Brazil needed to win the game by 3 goals in order to qualify for the next round, knocking out Scotland. Zaire needed to lose the game by less than 4 goals to save their lives and possibly harm to their family. So there is the suggestion that maybe this was an organized result, but it's hard to, I mean, allegedly, I don't have anything to prove this. This is just people on your question theorizing the possibilities of the outcome of that game.
From my perspective, even if it wasn't agreed between the teams, there's a point whereby if Brazil have got control of the game, which clearly they do, you know what I mean? Literally, if they're 2-0 up or 3-0 up, there's a point where you go, mate, we've got this. And you take the foot off the gas. Go, I don't need to bury it. If they knew, and media back in 1974, who knows whether they knew? Do you know what I mean? Who knows? But if they did know, you'd almost be sitting there going, mate, how hard do you want to go?
That game is fascinating. And you, as you say, they're sort of treading this tightrope between they have to lose. So if these two conspiracies are both there, they have to lose by 3 goals, but they can't lose by more. So, I mean, once they got to 3-0, they do need to stop the clock. To your point, it's interesting because actually Brazil, they do struggle to break them down. They score one in the first half. It's about midway through the second half, I think, before they get the second. Watching the game, there's no obvious sign that stuff's going. The keeper, it's fair to say, has, I would describe it as an eccentric game, but no more so than, I mean, it's very entertaining to watch because he's like David James in about 1988. He's kind of coming for every possible cross at the end of.
Did they reach
fantastic the watch. The original keeper is back for this one.
There you go.
He does let in something of a howler for the third goal. It has to be said. Right. It's a bit of a shocker.
Yeah.
But having seen how he performs for the rest of the game, it's difficult, really, because it'd be fair to say it's a mixed performance. He produces, having seen the some of the footage this afternoon, he produces some decent saves in there as well. So it's not obvious to me quite what's going on there, but the just can't imagine playing with that kind of pressure and that kind of confusion, how they're able to pull anything together in that game.
Here's a question. Is this the game where the phrase parking the team bus actually originated from? Because I can tell you right now, this is the game where you would want to park. This is the definition of wanting to park the team bus in front of goal, isn't it?
Definitely so. One of the many reasons I think this is such an iconic story is this extraordinary moment of free kick of a defensive ball. It's a fabulous, whether it is a statement of protest, an attempt to get sent off, or just plain, I can't imagine its stupidity, because I have seen, like, you know, there were other free kicks they've had to defend. They are presumably aware of what a defensive ball is. But also on top of that, you have this whole backstory of African country playing there with dictatorship, against that kind of backdrop. And then you also have this brilliant kit, you know, this fantastic green shirts. Yet, when you watch them play Brazil, they are playing in yellow shorts. And there's something, in that game, there's this weird kit clash where you've got Zaire in yellow shorts and Brazil in a yellow shirt. And it's a bit confusing to the eye, not terrible, but it's a bit confusing. I thought, well, I was, you know, that was probably what it was like in 1974. They didn't have another kit, you know, whatever it was. When you watch their previous game against Yugoslavia, they're in green shorts. So I don't know why they decided to play in yellow. It's very, very odd.
It sounds like the Haiti staff from the hotel probably sold their green shorts based on what's going on in the hotel. But I mean, to be fair, assuming the quality of the African nations back in 1974 is pretty good, let's face it, you look at them in sport, you've seen a billion brain fades that are pretty spectacular. I'm pretty sure this brain fade was the greatest time wasting ever, and good on him, what a great call. I mean, he may have been lauded for 35 years as an idiot, but in hindsight, he's probably now lauded as an absolute genius.
Yeah, unfortunately, The world lost Mwempu Olunga in 2015. He had a long illness, but he was one of the few that stayed within football. The rest of the Zaire team. So, to give you the context, when they went back to Zaire, they were picked up by the government officials and driven straight to the presidential house. They were kept in the presidential house for 4 days for a dressing down. They were banned from leaving the country. So anyone who'd seen any quality from the Zaire team that fancied taking them on outside the borders of Zaire couldn't transfer. It really is a tragic tale. So Ilunga stayed in football. We lost him recently, but there's a couple of examples. You've got Mabungo. He, you know, in 2010, he was a taxi driver, still driving the VW Passat that he was given in 1974 as his company taxi. And then you've got Malumba, the guy who scored the 9 goals, who got sent off for mistaken identity. I mean, his life just fell into absolute decline. He got shot in the leg a couple of times through a mugging because it was assumed he was a sportsman. He had lots of money. He didn't. Clearly, he ended the years of his life just living in poverty in a township in Cape Town. So it's a wonderful story, but it's triumph and tragedy, and it's got all of the ingredients, as you said, Graham, that would be. It is a brutal tale, and it would make a fascinating film because it's got all of those ingredients in it. And for Mobutu himself, I mean, you know, he just as the Zaire team were out, he moved on to the next project, which was arranging the Rumble in the Jungle, the Ali Foreman fight in Zaire.
The only problem with his story, though, is, you know, let's face it, Disney aren't going to be remaking it, are they? It lacks the cool runnings, feel-good ending.
Pretty brutal stuff. Just going back to a previous podcast where we talked about Michael Owen, who's only watched about 6 films in his life. Cool Runnings is actually one of those films. So I think Michael Owen likes his sporting movies.
He likes it. He likes his fairy tale sporting movies, at least anyway. So Zaire are definitely a great film-making story, but are they a great team? Shane, let me go to you first this time. Where would you rate them within the?
They're in the bottom category. The problem is, they have to be, don't they? I mean, it's 3 games they lost in the World Cup, and they get a percent out of it. But the thing about it is, from an African nations perspective, if you were just going to sit there and say greatness of African nations teams, they could be middle tier to top tier, because they're one of the first teams that, you know, winning African Nations Cup and all that. It's pretty impressive stuff. It's just that on a global scale, if I thought Australia were to get wiped by 400 teams, I think we could add another 400 teams to wiping the floor with this one. So I think they're bottom.
Jamie, a team that went to the World Cup, played 3 games and had a minus 12 goal difference. Can they be anything other than blinkered greats? Are you going to make the case?
It's a great... Can I make the case? I can make the case for it, yeah. I have to say, I do like Shane's directness on this. I mean, it's just straight to the point, and it's that quality, you know, Aussie attitude of say it as you see it, which, again, I'll just remind you of my new favourite place in Australia, which is the cave called, well, it wasn't there last year. I think I'm going to quote that one so many times. Only because that whoever named it must have been there the previous year and hadn't noticed the cave was there. Anyway, I'm giggling to myself and we should be talking about Zaire. I mean, we saw some of their qualities against Brazil, and you've referenced that. They held their own, and maybe there were some suspicious circumstances about the last 2 goals. We don't know. They held their own against a pretty good Scotland team, a Scotland team that we're going to cover at some point. And they had principles and pride, albeit slightly misguided in the eyes of the world, to protest the football match in the World Cup finals where the world is watching and get spanked by Yugoslavia. And they were brave to stand up to the president, and that backfired for them. I would chuck them into the bracket of edge of greatness, but I'm scrambling only to kind of open the debate with you, Graham.
Okay. Well, I'm going to shut that debate down because I'm inspired by Shane's Australian bluntness. They are the epitome, the pure definition of Lincoln greats. I love them, but you can't go any further with that. Zaire, 1974, Lincoln greats. So we have one last bit of business that we like to attend to on these things. It's our time machine. It's the opportunity where we go back and think if we are heading into Bill and Ted's phone booth and making our way back through the annals of time. If we had the choice for just one Saturday, which game and which team would we go back to? Do we go to Australia and the amazing World Cup performing side, or do we take it to Zaire 1974? Jamie, where are you going on this one?
Well, the first thing that came to my mind was maybe we should go to the Australia-Brazil game because none of us remember that, and one of us is actually there.
I have since revisited it, so I don't want to go back to it.
I think we should follow this up, Shane. So you aren't tempted back into that Australia-Brazil game again?
Look, I was impressed actually at the time. It was a bit of a dull game in that we were fighting against a good team whereby for a lot of it I thought we were limiting the damage and hoping to hit them on a break. So if you want to watch a game like that, I'm going to go to 1974. That's going to be entertaining. I mean, I might want to be surrounded by security at the time, but nonetheless.
You wouldn't be there when they're handing out the envelopes and the packages.
Correct. you want to see what really happened. With anything that's fresh in your memory, 2006 is reasonably fresh, and there was enough YouTube to be able to see it. I'd rather go back to something whereby, you know, there's spectacular stories around it, but not that much footage that's that easy. I mean, as I said, I'd like to have a security detail on my shoulder of ex-SAS people. Having said that, though, I'd still rather go back to something that's legendary but hard to find actual footage of.
Absolutely. What about you, Jamie?
Yeah, so I was torn between the Japan-Australia game, but I'd really only want to go for the last 10 minutes because it's just I do remember it. It was thrilling seeing Cahill score Australia's first goals in the World Cup final and then following up with a second and then the third. That was quite thrilling. But, yeah, I'm ashamed. I mean, you've got to go back to Germany in 1974, West Germany in 1974, and watch the Zaireans, really. It's just really which game I'd go back to. And I think I'd probably want to go back to the famous Yugoslavia game just to kind of see, you know, are they really not trying? Are they really protesting in a performance, which I think is a really challenging thing to do, to play a game of 90 minutes of football in a World Cup finals and demonstrate some level of protest, but still complete the game. I think that's a very skillful thing to do.
You'd like to be next to a supporter of the country as well when they substitute for the shortest goalkeeper. You'd like to hear a local's not just going, so what do you think of that move at 4-0 down with a lot of the games are still playing? You go, interesting.
I like to think there's someone three rows back who's saying, no, I've seen him play before. This makes sense. He's good on the deceptively good on crosses.
Yeah, amazing. That I'd like to go see that. That would be great to see.
Like you, Jamie, I mean, a part of me is tempted. If there was a way of communicating to Lucas Neal not, you know, to stay on his feet in that Italy game, then because that was a moment that you really, that was a killer moment. I think that was a killer moment. I think you were talking about it, Shane. You know that everyone outside of Italy was sort of backing Australia for that one, and you'd love to do it. I have to say, I'm not sure there's any talking Lucas Neal out of that tackle. Even if you went back.
You know what? I don't reckon the best thing is I doubt Lucas Neal even sits there and regrets. He goes, of course I'm going to go down and get him. even now when you notice the result, I reckon Lucas Neal probably goes, no, I'm doing it again.
So I think nicer that would be. How could I resist 1974 and that kit, that team, going to see Zaire? That's where we all have to be. So excellent. Thank you for your time, Shane. been great to have you on. We'll have you back again.
Would love to. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Had a great time. Thoroughly enjoyed it. Look forward to the next round of stories.
Jamie, we'll see you again soon.
You will. Yeah, I'll just echo what Shane said. That was fantastic. I really enjoyed that. Thank you.
So that's all we have time for this week. As ever, you can get in touch with any comments, additions or corrections about any of the teams we've talked about today. We'd love to hear any suggestions you have for other great teams we should cover. And if you enjoyed the podcast, please leave a review. Please like us. Please subscribe. And we'll see you again next time.